You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone. This is Robin Johnson, and welcome back to another edition of The Best of Heartland Politics, a radio show I began in 2014 that's now a regular podcast on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This show for today first aired in 2016 when I got very lucky scheduling an author whose book became a nationwide sensation and was made into a movie and elevated him into celebrity. The author is J.D. Vance, and the book is Hillbilly Elegy. It was seen at the time as a book that could perhaps explain the white working class, which was the key demographic group in the 2016 election. After Donald Trump's surprise win, many pundits looked to Vance's book as perhaps pointing to reasons for working class voters' affinity for a millionaire businessman and television celebrity. I arranged Vance's interview just before he became a national phenom, so I got pretty lucky here. His book was made into a movie produced by Ron Howard and starring Glenn Close. Vance went on to work in the tech industry and is now a Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate in Ohio. While Vance was originally more critical of Trump as an author, he has now adopted many of Trump's positions as a politician. This interview predates his prominence and offers his thoughts on the working class based on his upbringing in rural Kentucky and Ohio, as outlined in his book, Hillbilly Elegy. Here's Heartland Politics with J.D. Vance.
Good morning and welcome to Talking Politics. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And today we're going to be talking about a group of people in our country and who've been receiving a lot of attention of late in American politics. That's the white working class, loosely defined as those whites without college degrees. Here to talk about this group of people and their culture is J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. J.D., thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This book has been widely lauded and is an important book, especially for its timing. First of all, just talk a little bit here about what motivated you to write this book, and was this by design to kind of enter into the debate about the presidential election and the white working class?
It certainly wasn't the design. What happened is I started writing the book when I was a second-year student at Yale Law School. And what I found is that as much as the school was focused on diversity and including people from different backgrounds, it seemed to me that there weren't a lot of people at Yale like me. And so I started to ask some questions about why that was. Why was I the only person who felt like he was from a working class background? There may have been a couple others, but there were very few. Why weren't there other poor kids at places like Yale? And the questions that I asked when I started answering them, I started to think that the answers implicated something very deep within our culture and within what was going on in the broader world. And so it wasn't just a matter of something that was happening to me and my family. It was something apparently that was happening pretty broadly into a larger number of people. And so I really started to write the book to, like I said, to answer those questions. And as I wrote, I realized there was actually something a little bit broader and more meaningful to say. And frankly, the fact that it has had such relevance to the presidential election caught me by surprise a little bit. But also, if you read the book, you know that I did think that there was something political that was going to happen with all this anger and frustration in the white working class. And of course, we've now seen the form that it's taken.
Yeah, I have to say, when I started reading this, it was hard to put down because on a personal level, there were some similarities. Neither of my parents, and I was lucky enough to have two parent, be brought up in a two-parent household. But my grandmother was from, and both of my parents didn't have college degrees, but my grandmother was from Horse Cave, Kentucky, which is about 200 miles west of where your family had its roots in Kentucky. So a lot of this was familiar to me, and I thought it was very interesting. But basically, you take kind of an honest look at this culture and talk about how the positive aspects of it, but also the things that where the culture is kind of harming itself to some degree.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I didn't know that you grew up in that area. So what are the great things about the place where I grew up and the people that I grew up around is that they're incredibly loyal. So they care a lot about keeping things within the family, making sure that folks within the family are supported and taken care of. But on the flip side of that, they also in some ways judge and look down on the folks who leave the hollers or leave the places where they came from. We had a saying back where I came from that sometimes people got too big for their britches. And often what too big for your britches means is that you just went and tried to find a better life for yourself. And I really think that's not a good attitude to take, because when you grow up in a place like Eastern Kentucky or Southern Ohio, which is where I spent most of my childhood, whether you get out or not can sometimes be a binary proposition. So in Middletown, Ohio, where I grew up, there is one big blue-collar employer, AK Steel. It's been shedding jobs like a lot of other blue-collar employers for decades. And if you don't get a job there and you don't go somewhere else and find a job for yourself, then you're stuck in a town where there aren't a whole lot of prospects. And I think that we need to think real seriously within our own community and our own culture about how we can change attitudes to make it a little bit easier for kids like me to have a better chance.
You know, the globalization and the impact of globalization on our economy, especially in the Midwest here and in rural areas where a lot of manufacturing migrated, has been a topic I brought up. I got to interview most all the presidential candidates, and that's one of the topics I asked them, because Burlington, where our show is here, is a city that's very dependent on manufacturing in the past. And it seems like our leaders pursued globalization based on theories without really understanding the consequences that were going to happen when the production of goods moved from here. And you cite this as one of the leading factors that's led to kind of the challenges that the white working class culture faces.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that the biggest problem is that when folks at the elite level, at the political level, when they think about globalization, they think about the benefits, right? They think about cheaper goods and services. They think about the free movement of labor and manufacturing and equipment across borders. And that is good in a lot of ways. It does make a lot of people's lives better. But the places that are most exposed to that increased competition, to the labor competition, to manufacturing moving overseas, those places actually lose out extraordinarily badly. And so there was a very interesting study done by a former Obama administration economist that looked at kind of the effect of competition from Chinese labor on local economies in the U.S. And what it found, and it wouldn't surprise anybody who's lived in these areas, is that the places that are most exposed to Chinese competition in the U.S. are extraordinarily destitute. You see rising rates of joblessness. But not just that, you see rising rates of addiction and divorce, family breakdown. And so these problems that we think of, I think, in some ways as economic, and it certainly have in some cases economic roots, I don't think they're all economic, they have much, much broader application and much, much broader impact. And I think that's really at root what this book is about, right? It's about how do these people react and how do these people live in these worlds when the industrial economy really goes south and there aren't good jobs to have anymore.
And it was a total lack, and it was bipartisan. I'm being fair here, and I think you are too. Sure. In the book, this is both parties not understanding the working class. And it just slays me when I see these pundits on the East Coast having these discussions about the working class, and they have no clue. And that's why I'm glad your book came out. It's welcome, because you've lived this and you were able to articulate this culture and these viewpoints.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate how disconnected the elites are, I think, from these working class communities. I think in a lot of ways, it's bred a sort of resentment that folks back home feel towards elites of both parties. And I think we're seeing that manifest itself in our politics. But it really is unfortunate, because I think at root, these communities are really good. They're full of good people. They're full of people who want to do well by themselves and by their children. And unfortunately, we have a political class, again, on both parties that I don't think is really responsive to the concerns of a lot of these people. And, you know, one of the things I've talked about recently, I had an interview where I mentioned that, you know, that a lot of people think that Donald Trump's supporters are all racists or xenophobes. They just hate Muslims or Mexicans or whoever else. And I'm not a fan of Trump's rhetoric on that topic. I wish that he talked about these problems in a different way. But fundamentally, the people who are supporting Trump are not racists writ large. I think what they are is that they're struggling and that they've seen firsthand that the policies of both parties have really failed their communities, and they're just reacting against it.
Yeah, I was tapping into some of that anger last summer, June of 15, at the base level here in Iowa, prior to the caucuses. And I had some people telling me Trump is going to be very attractive. He's going to drive the debate. I'll never forget that. And I kind of laughed it off. Well, it was true. And yeah. It's driven, again, people I know and talk to. I live, as my listeners know, across the river and teach at Monmouth College. And I see working class people every day. I get this. Racism plays a part of this, but it's not the whole story. And that's what the left is ignoring here to their own detriment, because I think you're going to see – that's why apparently I heard last night that Clinton and Kaine, when they leave the convention, are going to do a tour through Pennsylvania and up into Michigan, states with a heavy concentration of the white working class.
Kind of funny, isn't it, that everybody is now realizing, either because of Trump or just because of everything else, that these communities are, I think, really, really upset, and they're, I think, really ready to hear a political message that appeals to them. I think it's interesting that for so long these communities have been largely ignored, and now, you know, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia are on everybody's mind as we end this election season. And it's not surprising. I think, you know, like you said, for those of us who live in these areas, I think we saw this coming last year. I was talking to a friend late summer, and I said, you know, I really think that Trump could be the nominee. And he said, no, you're crazy. He's going to flame out like Michelle Bachmann or Herman Cain did in 2012. I said, I don't know. I think there's something real here. And of course, now we know that there was something real, and it's just going to continue until things start to take an upward turn.
Well, one thing your book talks about that you put in there, that the thing you'd like to most change about the white working class is the feeling that our choices don't matter. Talk about that a little bit, as far as how that manifested itself, what you saw in the people in your life, and that their choices didn't matter. It's kind of almost a feeling of hopelessness.
Yeah, it's definitely a feeling of hopelessness. I think that the message that our community had in some ways for a lot of the kids was that it didn't really matter whether you worked hard in school. It didn't really matter whether you worked hard at your job. At a fundamental level, the deck was kind of stacked against you, and things, you know, no matter what happened, things wouldn't work out. I remember when I got into Yale Law School, which of course was a big deal for me personally. Somebody asked if I had pretended to be a liberal, and I said, no, why do you think that? And their response was, well, I thought they always let liberals in places like that. And I think that what that speaks to is that if you're from these communities and you don't know a whole lot of people that go to places like Yale, then you can assume the system is rigged. And you hear that a lot. That's almost a mantra of Donald Trump's campaign, that the system is rigged. But if you believe the system is rigged, then you don't necessarily want to work hard to give yourself a better life, to give your kids a better life. And so one of the things that I write about in the book is that, you know, I think that people on the left try to think of this problem primarily as what I'll call a structural problem. It's underfunded schools, it's inequality, it's not enough resources for addiction treatment centers. And people on the right try to think of this problem as a pure failing of moral agency. These people just need to make better choices. They need to, you know, to do better by themselves, and there's nothing the government can do. And I think the reality of the problem, at least as I saw it from my life, is that it's all of these things, that there are a lot of problems. There's a sense of learned helplessness. There's a sense that our choices don't matter. But then there are also ways that the economy has not well served us. And I think that if you're not honest about all of these things, then fundamentally you're not going to truly understand the problem.
You're listening to Talking Politics on KBRAM 1490 Burlington Iowa. Our guest today is J.D. Vance, the author of Hillbilly Elegy, a really fascinating book. I urge everybody out there to get it, buy it, take a look at it. Burlington is white working class country, and a lot of these stories are going to resonate. J.D., another interesting part of your book, and you know, I want to talk about potential solutions here in a bit, but you talk about the deep mistrust of institutions in the white working class, and how conservatives, instead of talking about engagement and talking about stories about how people can overcome that, like your story, but instead they seem to feed on it. Talk about that a little bit, if you would, please.
Yeah, they definitely do, and I think that part of it is just that when you're down and when you feel like somebody's kicking you in the gut, you can either, curl up in a ball, or you can try to stand back up. And I think there are competing demands on people's psychologies and on the lives that they lead. I think on the one hand, there's a lot of pessimism that things just aren't going to get better. But the problem with that pessimism is that it encourages you not to change the parts of your life that you do have control over. So I do think that there's an important role for a culture to think about, well, what can we do? Sure, things aren't perfect. Sure, we're getting, sure, the economy isn't really working for us. Sure, things aren't totally easy for us. But what can we do nonetheless? Can we be better parents in the face of this? Can we be a little bit better to the kids in our neighborhood who maybe don't have a two-parent family at church? Can we preach a gospel of engagement as opposed to a gospel of disengagement? I think all these things matter. And at the end of the day, if we want to make this problem better, I think we both have to think about the political solution to the problem, but we also have to think about the ways that our own choices could be a little bit better too.
And it just seems like a vicious cycle. And I know people this way, single parent families. And again, I'm not denigrating them. I'm just saying that the statistics show that the kids raised in single parent households have a lot of factors working against them. Welfare, drug addiction, and I don't want to stereotype, but again, the data's there, and you pointed out, it's just hard to break that cycle, and these folks need some kind of help, but mostly it's going to have to be part of it just generated within themselves.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's, unfortunately, like you said, family breakdown is, I think, a really big part of the problem here, because when you grow up in a home that's chaotic, where you're moving from one place to the other every 6 months, it makes the rest of your life harder, right? It makes it harder to concentrate at school, makes it harder to do your homework, makes it harder to trust the people around you. And I think that when you grow up in a home like that, as I did, you start to really learn bad habits. You learn bad habits about how people are supposed to disagree with one another. You learn bad habits about what it means to be a good husband or spouse. And so these problems end up just multiplying, right? Chaos and instability begets chaos and instability. You come from a broken home, so you escape it, and then you start a broken home for your kids, and then they're even worse off than you are. I think that's definitely the story of my family. It's a story that you saw a lot in our community. And unfortunately, I think that's one of those problems that's going to be really hard for the government to fix. It might be able to help a little bit, but at the end of the day, we've got to take some responsibility, and that runs down the whole gamut of issues, from addiction, which is a terrible, terrible problem. But we have to be upfront about the fact that addiction is worse in the white working class than it is in the working class of any other race. More kids from the white working class are dying of heroin than kids from any other race. So we can't totally chalk this up to things that are outside of our control, because I just don't think that fits with the data, and I certainly don't think it fits with the experience of the people who live in these places.
Yeah, it just, as you say in your book, it doesn't lend itself to some magical public policy, somebody coming from Washington saying, here, we're going to solve your problems. Government can perhaps have a helpful role, but it's really not going to have a leading role, is it?
No, it's certainly not, and I think that it's, you know, the problem here is that so many of these issues are, you know, they predate in some ways even the decline of the industrial economy. And so it's very hard to kind of point to a government policy and say, hey, that's going to make people divorce less. That's going to make people, you know, be more involved in their kids' lives. That's going to make people better spouses to their husbands or wives. You know, that's going to make people more engaged in their community. There aren't really any magic bullets. I do believe that the government can help these things, as you said, a little bit. But I do think that help has to come along with a what I would call a culture of willfulness, a belief that we're not helpless, that we can control at least some parts of these problems. And without that recognition, I really don't think the problems are ever going to get a lot better.
I was really interested in your description of the role of religion, especially with your grandmother. And it struck home for me because my grandmother, again, she was originally from Horse Cave, Kentucky. She was very religious, always talked to me when somebody was facing problems. She would always say, I remember, it's not as bad as what Job faced in the Bible. But yet she never went to church. And she was similarly skeptical of organized religion. That was one of the most interesting parts because it related to me so closely on a personal level.
Yeah, my grandma was just this incredible woman in a lot of ways, and was very, very devout and ensured that I learned the Christian faith and that it was an important part of my life. But like you said, she ultimately didn't go to church very much. And I think that the problem with that, and I think that if you look at the statistics, this bears itself out, is that church is a really important part of, I think, meaningfully engaging in the Christian faith or in any other faith. You know, if you think about what church does for kids, it provides in the community. It can give people social support. It can, you know, I saw a couple of times in my dad's church where the church would take collections for people who were down on their luck and help them and give them a hand up. And it also provides a sense of moral pressure, you know, that you shouldn't be drinking, that you shouldn't be doing drugs, that you should work hard in school, that you should treat your family well. I learned all of those messages from my engagement with church and my engagement with Christian faith. And the problem that I see is that the actual church attendance rates in the white working class are really plummeting. So people say that they're evangelical, they say that they're Christian, but if you actually look at the data, they're going to church much less than they used to. And I think that part of this problem, this very complex problem, this decline in church attendance is just another variable and a negative one at that.
Yeah, the one institution that seemed to have a role and perhaps played a turning point in your life is the military when you enlisted in the Marines. And of course, you talk about the fact that a disproportionate number of members of the military are from the white working class. So that really was kind of a key point in your life.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I said that the Marine Corps for me was like this 4-year education of character development. When I started my time in the Marines, I was, even though my grandma had done her best, I was in a lot of ways a pretty messed up kid. I didn't have a whole lot of direction. I didn't have that ability to kind of pull an all-nighter and work really hard when it came down to it, just because I'd never been asked to. That had never been really demanded of me. And ultimately, you know, I hadn't accomplished a lot in my life at that point. You know, I think that one of the things that's interesting about growing up in a world where things are constantly chaotic is that you don't sit around and collect all these accolades and extracurricular activities that you do when you grow up in a relatively privileged household. And so all of these things that I didn't have by the time I was 18 or 19 years old, I did have because the Marine Corps forced me to have it, sometimes with a lot of screaming and yelling to go along with it. And, of course, you know, what the Marine Corps does is it puts you in situations that you've never been before. It forces you to do something that you didn't think you could do. And if you fail, it makes you go at it again. And if you succeed, it gives you another challenge on top of it. I've been in the Marine Corps about 2.5 years when, just because of a shortage of manpower, the major that was in charge of our little unit gave me the job of a captain and said, for the next 7 months, because, you know, we're short with people, you're going to do his job. And it was just this awesome experience for me. It created this incredible sense of self-confidence that has continued to pay dividends. But without the Marine Corps, I would have never had any of that. I would have, I think, in a lot of ways, continued to be what I hope is a good kid with a good heart, but a kid who was really closed off from what was possible in the world and possible out of life.
So much more to talk about, but I only have time for one more question here, and I'm trying to narrow it down. I think I would ask this of you. I think, based on other books I've read, The Fractured Republic has come out by Yuval Levin, which is very, very good, realistic look at what's going on and how we're going to try to solve these issues. I think one of the big things for the white working class is mentorships and just seeing role models. But you talk about how rare those are in government and the military, and the fact that residential segregation, they're not around. Working class people aren't around other groups as much. Just talk about that a minute, and I'm trying to narrow that down for a good question for you, but how can we get better mentors, people that look up to that might have, I'm sure would have a good role in starting to turn things around a little bit?
Sure. That's a very important part of this. And if you look at the residential segregation statistics, what I mean there is that if you actually drill down into these neighborhoods, they're increasingly becoming stratified by income and by class, and even by race. So if 30 years ago, the middle class and the working class were pretty well integrated in neighborhoods, you know, maybe the middle class folks had nicer homes, but they were still within walking distance of lower class folks, that's increasingly not true. We are now a very segregated country by class. You have poor kids living only with poor kids, and middle class kids living only with middle class kids and upper class kids and so on. And so one of the teachers that I spoke to while I was doing some research for the book, he told me, when you grow up in a neighborhood and the only other people are other poor kids, other families who are struggling to get by, you start to think that's normal. You start to think that that's the only thing that's out there for kids who are like you, is the struggle and the week-to-week paycheck and all of the domestic chaos that comes with it. And what we really need to do, I think, is consider ways that we might honestly reintegrate. I think that's how we have to think about it, reintegrating the upper and the lower classes in this country. One of the things I talk about is Section 8 vouchers. So Section 8 is, of course, a government program. Gives people a voucher to live in a given home. What has happened with the Section 8 program and its administration is that the government has focused Section 8 vouchers on certain neighborhoods and certain cities and towns. So like Middletown, where you have an extraordinarily high number of kids who are on Section 8, which means that they're poor, which means that they don't have exposure to kids from other backgrounds. I think that if you even just administering that program in a way that was mindful of not segregating the poor into these little neighborhood enclaves would have a really huge effect. And I hope that maybe somebody will read this book and think, well, we should do that and change some things, but I won't hold my breath, I guess.
Yeah. I unfortunately, our two parties are locked into just these ideological and mind-numbing, instant talking points without giving really true thought to this. And one of the things I loved about your book and books that I like in general are those that cut through the talking points and admit that some things the left says are true and some things the right says are true. And to find a truth, we're going to have to take parts of both. But again, as somebody who was raised in the working class, I really appreciate this book. You did a great job with it. J.D. Vance has been our guest today. He's the author of Hillbilly Elegy. I recommend it. It's a great and timely book because this is a group that probably will decide this presidential election, especially right here in the Midwest. J.D., thanks again for being our guest today.
Yeah, thank you. It was great to talk to you.